I see all these people flipping out about these cartoon apes, and I'm like, what? What are these apes? Like, what is going on?
One of the best things that NFTs have brought to the table is they have made collecting so accessible to people.
All my early collectors are OGs in my mind.
But for me, art is like a need. It's not a want, and collecting is just another form of that.
I clicked really fast on the Beeple drop, and I actually managed to get it for $1.
If I've collected your work, I'm holding it with diamond hands.
If you're collecting something, it could become hot in 2 minutes or 200 years.
Welcome to The Collector's Call, where we chat about art with the top collectors and creators in Web3. I'm your host, Scooter, and today my guest is Harvey Rayner, an artist and creative coder with over 25 years of digital and generative art experience. His large and varied body of work reveals an evolution in formalized geometric approaches to art making. His work is a unique blend of compositional restraint and precision, coupled with playful dynamism and a daring boldness. Harvey is also an avid rock climber and has maintained a daily meditation practice for over 2 decades. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Harvey. Harvey, welcome to the Collector's Call.
Thanks for inviting me here today. Looking forward to this one. This is going to be good.
Well, let's dive right in. I've got some intro questions about your background, lots about your art, and then a little bit on collecting at the end. To kick things off, you've mentioned that you had an interest in art and creating, which began as early as the age of 2. What are some of your earliest memories that ignited your passion for artistic expression?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't have known it as at that age, but it's just my earliest memory is just painting these kind of scribbles at preschool when I was like, maybe I was 3, I don't know, 2, 3, like super early. And I was scribbling these things, and I had that one of the helpers came along and like tried to tell me that one of them was good when I really loved one of them and I hated the other one. And I felt, so I kind of screwed up and hid it, and somebody found it under my chair and I was devastated. So, you know, even at that age, I think I had a strong sense of at least what I liked. I mean, these were both just scribbles, you know, but I still had a sort of, obviously that was important to me, that sort of aesthetic kind of sensibility, even at that sort of young age. So yeah. And then, you know, throughout my childhood, I spent a lot of time playing with Lego actually, but I also, you know, I did a huge amount of drawing and painting, and, you know, it's just something I've done my whole life.
Yeah, it sounds like that was a very early field of exploration, and it makes sense that you wouldn't characterize it as art from that young age, but still interesting that you felt the tug of this discipline when you were just a child. Last week, you shared a self-portrait that you had created when you were younger, and in your words, quite intense and serious. You now have a much more lighthearted approach to your art. What accounts for that evolution in your outlook?
Interesting question. I think maybe it's maybe a reflection of just me as a person. Maybe, you know, when I was young, I was certainly sort of like, I was very hungry, I would say, for truth. You know, I was a seeker, you know, like the whole, and I was quite unhappy, you know, I was happy as a child, but I think going into adolescence, you know, and certainly like young, early 20s, I was going for a bit of a crisis. So I think that portrait maybe captures this, the star of that period for me. But as you know, as I've grown older, I've just become, maybe I just gained some perspective, you know, so I can see that maybe this whole thing is not quite as important. I mean, I'm super passionate about it and I love it, but I also have maybe gained a little bit of a perspective on what maybe really matters, or some context, you know. I can now see it in the context of my whole life and the relationships I've built, my family. You know, and I've got to say, I also know that the truth I was maybe trying to seek back then, I'm not going to find that in something, I'm not going to find it outside of myself. So maybe there's a confidence in that, which enables me to be a bit more lighthearted, maybe. Having said that, you know, I'm not saying I'm lighthearted all the time. I get serious and stressed like anybody else. So, you know, that's an interesting question. I'd have to ponder that some more to give you a really good answer, I think.
No, I appreciate that reflection. I pinned this image. I like that. I think you had called it a little bit flat as well, and you came back to it later on and embellished it with some other marks. And I like that idea. That seems like that is akin to some of what you're working on more recently with trying to enliven things and bring a bit of light to them. You've mentioned in your past purchasing a manual on meditation that had a profound impact on you. I'm wondering if you could share the story of how you came across that manual and the changes it brought about in your life.
Oh, God. Yeah, that's a big story. So I'll try to keep it brief. So I went to art school when I was 19, I think, yeah, 19. And that's when I started to get super intense because up until, when I was I couldn't read until I was 18. And, I'm pretty sort of maybe dyslexic. I don't know. But anyway, I couldn't read and I kind of learned to read when I was 18. But then I went to art school. I got introduced to thought, and philosophy. And I just dove right into it. And I was reading, Nietzsche and all sorts of things. And I just sort of went into my head and became very neurotic. But I was so hungry to find a way out because I kind of knew that I'd lost this kind of innocence I had as a child. I think, but the fact that I couldn't read, I think made me quite simple. it kept me, I think it prolonged my childhood and kind of prolonged maybe my innocent view of the world. And so anyway, I was in a bookshop one day and I picked up a book of sacred geometry because I was kind of getting interested in geometry back then. I had this little verse in there and it was something like all in one, one in all. If only this can be realized, then no more worry about being perfect. And it was a verse from a Zen text. And it really struck me. And I thought, wow, whoever wrote this kind of gets it. And I don't, and I thought I need to learn more about this. So I went into the Zen section. I picked up this book called The Three Pillars of Zen, which was kind of it was the only real manual at the time of how to meditate and so forth. And it was written by a teacher who lived at the time in Rochester, which is where I now live. Well, very close to where I live. And I read in this book, and that's got these accounts of these Westerners who'd been out to Japan and studied with these Zen teachers, following this extremely sort of strict and kind of rigorous lifestyle. And it had these sort of accounts of them kind of having a little bit of a breakthrough after 6-10 years of training. And it just I thought, oh my God, I got to do this. I need this, I want this breakthrough too, So that day, I started to meditate. That day I meditated 3 hours, not in one go, but in blocks. And I built this kind of daily practice to try and have the same type of experience. And of course, after many years of trying, it didn't work, but I was so hungry for it, but it did. I would say it didn't work. It did sort of take the edge off my neuroticism, and it did kind of after maybe a year of this sort of intense practice of meditating for hours a day, I started to kind of maybe fall in love with people again, and see the humor and things, but I never kind of reached that kind of peak goal. But then I think as my practice developed over the years, I realized that probably that's not sustained. It's for most of us, that's never going to be a sustainable kind of thing anyway. It's kind of a brief kind of, I don't know, flash in the pan for many people, but yeah, so it did really impact my life and it's still something that I do, not as much as I did when I was younger, but I still do. I meditated for half an hour before this call just to sell myself. And yeah, it's a big part of my life still. And I still kind of feel like I would, in some ways, I'd like to get back to where I was when I was younger and find that thirst again, maybe. I don't know. I'm getting to do something that I've always wanted to do is, spend my whole life making art full time. This has kind of always been my dream. So it's, since in those periods where you get everything that you want, that maybe, your practice is most challenged.
certainly can be. Artists seem to have very, very busy minds and active ideas. And so it seems like meditation is a great practice to help settle some of that inner turmoil that's often existing. I found it fascinating to hear you talk about not being able to read, prolonging your innocent outlook of the world. That's something that wouldn't have sprung to mind for me, but makes sense when you think about it. I'm curious, you've mentioned a little bit on meditation already in that story. I understood that you had relinquished some of your possessions as a part of your exploration and pursuit of meditation and lived almost a nomadic life for a while. Is that the case?
Yeah, I did. So after sort of just living in a squat for a couple of years in London, like doing this kind of making art and meditating, basically is what I was doing. Cause I quit art school. I sort of like sold pretty much everything I had. And then enough to actually raise money for a plane ticket to come to America to go and find this teacher who wrote this book, you know, in Rochester. So I ended up sort of hitchhiking from Toronto to there with no money. I mean, I spent my first $20 on my first day, so I had nothing in my pocket. And I just, you know, I knew I could live out of trash cans and sleep under bridges and what have you. So I did that. And then once I got to Rochester, I decided actually that's not the life I wanted. It's a complicated story, but I decided I didn't want to stay there. And I ended up just living like that for 6 more months, traveling around America, hitchhiking, riding freight trains, but, you know, without any money whatsoever. If people gave me money, I often used to just give away because I didn't, it kind of actually didn't like it because it then gave me choices and options when I knew I could live perfectly well. Well, I think perfectly well in trash cans. It sounds terrible, but actually you'd be surprised what I used to get, you know. So it's actually ironic. It was the only time in my life I actually gained weight because I generally ate so well, you know. So yeah, so I led that life. And then at the end of that trip, I ended up meeting my wife. You know, I met a guy who introduced me to a woman. I kind of fell in love with her, and we ended up, you know, conceiving a child pretty quickly. So that ended that lifestyle pretty quickly. So, you know, I was then sort of like become a family man, you know, straight after that experience. But it was, I've got a lot of good stories from that time. It was kind of, you know, a pretty amazing little chapter in my life.
It does sound amazing. We'll have to have a separate discussion around On the Road with Harvey and hear some of those behind the scenes stories of your exploits. I love the idea of you gaining weight from some of your pursuits during that time. I was intrigued to learn that your interest in meditation led to the creation of a customized meditation cushion. I think this is one of your well-guarded secrets. Could you just comment briefly on how meditation influences your art practice and your perspective on art?
Wow, yeah, you've done your research. So yeah, I created that cushion. It's called the Moonleap cushion for myself because I used to go on these long retreats, you know, like 10, 15 years ago. I used to go away quite a lot, and I have experienced various severe pains in my butt and my legs would fall asleep. So I figured I'd try to create a cushion to solve that problem. And it's something that really worked well for me. So we ended up sort of like thinking, well, maybe other people want this, and we turned it into a business. And it's kind of been our bread and butter for up until NFTs, really, you know. So how does it affect my art practice? I think, you know, art for me is like inspiration comes out of like a balance of activity, out of work and silence. You know, when you get that balance right, where you have periods in your life, you know, in your day where you're not thinking much, where you're, you know, you're just still, and then you combine with periods of kind of like, you know, work and focused kind of activity. That's for me when the best kind of like problem solving happens, is when inspiration just is always, you know, it's not like I need to go somewhere to get inspired. It's just a constant kind of flow, really. And finding that balance is, you know, obviously meditation or like walking in, you know, in nature with my dog and stuff, that helps me to find that balance. And then also I think just helps, you know, there's responsibilities with this job as there is with any job. I don't think of being a Web3 artist is more stressful than any other job, right? But it helps to deal with, you know, the stressful situations when they come along, pressure and so forth. It just provides a perspective, right? It's, you know, suddenly when I sit on my cushion after a little while, I can see there's sort of like space around all my problems, and they don't seem so close. You know, it's like stepping outside of the problems and thinking, okay, I can see this in the context of everything else, and they're okay. You know, they're not something I have to run away from. They're just okay. So that's how it would help with creativity, I think. But it's more like it just helps, you know, for me, like I'm not good at working under pressure. Like I don't like deadlines. I think it actually impedes my creativity. Some artists like deadlines, you know, because it stops them procrastinate maybe, but I prefer to kind of like work in a more relaxed way. Yeah. And yeah, so the meditation is always going to help bring that balance into my life.
Absolutely. Providing some context and space for you to really ground yourself sounds like a benefit for any of us. Certainly a pursuit that I should pursue a little bit more closely. Thanks for providing that background. You were reluctant to begin using computers to create your artwork. What eventually led you to embrace this medium?
I would say necessity, because, you know, yes, right. My wife bought a computer, I think, in 2001, or it might have been 2000, and to use email. And I didn't touch it for a year. I just stubbornly refused to go near the thing. But I was making art from geometry, like with a compass and rule, and it was getting more and more sophisticated. And it was taking me longer and longer to build these kind of, to paint these compositions. And I realized at some point, oh God, this is going to just grow exponentially. The complexity is going to grow kind of like a Moore's law, you know, in terms of complexity. And I figured, well, computer's the right move here. And so it was a kind of a slow, you know, it was a steep learning curve. I was using it in bizarre ways to begin with, you know, but slowly, I think once I discovered like vector drawing software, CorelDRAW was what I used. And I kind of learned how to use it effectively to kind of like replace my compass and rule. And then I once I got into it, I loved it, you know, but it was a little bit of a steep learning curve. And I'm a lot like that. I actually feel quite slow to take up new things. I have to kind of resist them for a period of time. But then when I finally kind of like break through, I kind of get pretty obsessed and, you know, move pretty fast with it. But there's always that period of resistance first. That period of resistance, should I say.
It feels like that period of resistance can be important for someone's practice. It's almost a way of identifying whether this is a real passion or something that will stick with you. So I'm happy to hear you acknowledge that. I'm intrigued by individuals within the Web3 space who've had a presence with Web2 technology, and that was certainly the case for you. Some of your early digital artwork involved creating backgrounds for people to use on Tumblr, MySpace, and their blogs. Could you tell us about Pattern Cooler and what you explored through that site?
Yeah, so because I made work with geometry, you know, one of the sort of spin-offs from that was these kind of like seamless pattern tiles. And I had them on my art website, and it was kind of like the only thing that really got attention. It was also, you know, like I would optimize the website for key terms and stuff, and it got a lot more traction than the rest of my website. So, and people would sort of like ask me if I could make this pattern and this color and so forth. And I would do that for a bit. And then I figured, well, if I learned to code, you know, if I learned to JavaScript, I could build an app, you know, it wasn't an app back then, but, a utility so people could change the colors and change the size and add textures. And so that became this kind of like, that project, Pattern Cooler, became this my introduction into sort of like fairly serious coding. And I went through several iterations of that project, and it grew into, you know, like a decent project. And I put a donations button on there, and I actually generated a small income, which was a significant income for me back then, because we didn't really have much money. So, and you know, it was a passion project. I loved the spirit of the project. It was kind of happy, and people seemed to really like it. A lot of schools used it. I should resurrect the project really, because there's still a lot of people who like it, but it's kind of like I haven't maintained it. So yeah, then that led on to me sort of like people. I worked for a number of startups, or like building pattern editing UIs for like companies who want to do custom prints on products like dresses and, you know, like cushions and curtains and things like that. So that then, you know, that led to me kind of like becoming more of a proficient coder. The whole, you know, I became like this SVG pattern specialist. But yeah, I always, you know, I do like that, what I did with that project. I think it has, you know, when you see the project, it's fun, you know, it has that kind of similar to Chatfucker, maybe it has a nice, fun, happy vibe. And I also learned a lot about kind of like building tools where people always get a good result. You know, I built some really complex pattern editing tools, and I learned actually when you introduce all the, you know, more powerful tools, you've got more potential for the user to have to create bad results. So when you build a tool like that, it's this fine balance of kind of introducing power against like always ensuring that you get good results. I think I also like my Fontana project, the generative color algorithm actually has its roots in an algorithm I wrote for that project to make generative color for the patterns.
Oh, that's interesting to hear. I really like the term you used, pattern specialist. In a way, I think that could be applied to a lot of the prominent figures within the generative art world, and I haven't heard that phrase used before. It's interesting to hear some of your evolution working with companies and creating this site for other users to engage with, and a lot of experimentation along the way, including your design of a logo for SVG that won a competition and continues to be used today. What did that accomplishment mean to you?
It was just kind of fun. I'd never entered a competition before, and I don't think I've ever entered one since. So I got 100% strike rate. I was surprised that I won. It was funny because my prize was this, like, one of the first ever smartphones. It was quite expensive for the time. And then I had it one day and I left it in my pants and my wife put it in. Well, I put it out to be washed, basically, and it went through the washing machine and killed it. So, but aside from that, I was, you know, obviously happy to win. I now look at the logo and think, oh, I wish they would. I've asked them since if they would let me kind of like tweak it to bring it up, you know, just because it's starting to look a bit clunky, you know, it's starting to look a little dated, but they're happy with it and they don't want to change it. So, but it was cool. I'd actually forgotten about it up until I tweeted about it recently. I can't remember where it came up. Yeah, maybe somebody, it came up on the spaces, and I'd almost like forgotten that I'd had that relationship with SVG, and yeah, SVG sort of like is so important to me. It's, you know, it's like I'm one of the few artists who uses it extensively in their work. So yeah, it's kind of an interesting story in the context of SVG, really, I guess.
It is, and it's an accomplishment that's worth remembering. I'm glad you resurfaced that one. Let's dive into your digital art within the NFT space. You referenced Fontana already, which was released with Artblocks Curated, and explores motion through static art as well as generative color. What was your interest in experimenting with those elements?
Well, generative color just seemed to make sense. You know, my first Artbox project, Photon Stream, it was always going to be a generative color algorithm, but I kind of bottled it last minute. And it's kind of like a hybrid project, actually. It doesn't have sort of like fixed palettes, but it has like fixed presets that feeds into, like, it has an array of fixed presets that feeds into a color algorithm. But I just got scared that you know, was still some outputs I weren't happy with in terms of the colors the algorithm was generating. So I kind of like, yeah, I sort of like done a hybrid with that project. But then Fontana, I sort of worked more on the algorithm, and I got to a point where I was happy with, you know, pretty much everything that was being outputted by the algorithm. So it just made sense. You know, just like I figured, well, you know, everything else is kind of like is algorithmic. Why would you have this one component of the art, which is kind of like fixed, which is, you know, so it just seemed more authentic to have a generative color algorithm. And I'm still of that mindset, you know, everything I do, you know, even Chatfuckers, it's all generative color. So, and the motion, the idea with the sort of like futurism and representing motion with these kind of like static, kind of like technical drawing type elements was just really, it kind of evolved with the artwork itself. You know, I didn't start with that idea. It was based on this geometry I'd explored for maybe 20 years prior. And it just, that's just when I saw it sort of, you know, rendered on the screen and using the generative algorithm, that's just what it spoke to me. It seemed like it was, you know, they looked like fountains. They looked like they were expressing this type of movement. And yet the sort of the language I was building around it looked like had this kind of like technical drawing element, which is, again, this very sort of methodical type, you know, slow practice. And I love that tension. You know, I'm always looking for that tension in art, this kind of paradox. So I just went with that theme and kind of, you know, sort of wrote, kind of like framed the whole project around that idea of this kind of play of time and also like motion and static elements. It's a concept, you know, it's a bunch of concepts, which is fairly digestible for the sort of like gen up for my audience at the time. And, you know, I also tied it back to like, you know, the futurism movement, what they were trying to accomplish there. So it wasn't too heady. It didn't seem too kind of outrageous, too much of an outrageous stretch. So yeah, so often my concepts in my work, you know, they're I'll co-evolve with the, it may start with a visual idea and then I'll try to provide some sort of conceptual framing for it as the project evolves.
You put a lot of thought into your work, and I really appreciate the Medium articles that you've shared around most of your longer form generative projects. They're great for understanding the background to them. For a non-technical person like me, they're also helpful to understand what's actually happening in a down-to-earth way, at least as accessible as it can be relayed. That's something that's quite valuable. So thank you for offering that. We should turn to the exciting new project that you've referenced already, Chatfuckers, which is a fully generative art PFP project coming to Ordinals very soon. What is a Chatfucker and how did this project come into existence?
Okay, so the project began, and I've said this many times on Spaces, but I'll say it again. It started with it evolved again over a period of time. It wasn't like I just sat down one day thinking, oh, I think I'll do a PFP project. It wasn't like that. I started with the idea of doing a project under a pseudonym, and that kind of like led me to think, well, I can do anything here. It was very liberating. I can't actually recommend any artist try that, even if they don't follow through, if they do announce it. At the time I was sincere and I really did think I would do it anonymously. So it kind of like liberated me. And I started to think about these paintings I made when I was a teenager, like 17, 18 years old. These screaming kind of disembodied heads, these kind of fetus like creatures, monsters, which I loved. And I still love these paintings. But I never felt like I could go back there and explore them because they kind of seemed a little childish, in my later years as a serious artist, But I figured, well, okay, let's go back to that theme and see if I can recreate these geometrically. And in my mind, I could see myself hitting the refresh button and seeing these monsters appear on the screen. And that really excited me. So, I started to do that. And then this kind of theme, it seemed like these creatures could be like these trolls that evolve on the interconnected sort of web servers, like this idea of AI evolving in the wild, which I really love. I can't remember the guy who came up with that idea, but this like AI that evolves without humans knowing it, just sort of like in the depth of this, all of these kind of servers that are interconnected around the world. And it's sort of like the idea that it kind of lift off the kind of chat, or the Discord kind of degen, kind of like torrent of kind of conversation that's what it fed off. And then the scream kind of made sense because this thing was just coming online, like it was just waking up, and it was kind of like a baby that's just been born, and it was his first kind of like scream or existential scream. And so that was kind of like the myth that grew around what I was seeing on the screen. And then that fed into the name, Chatfucker. It was from, I guess a play on ChatGPT and, that just how chat is so common, a common word in the space is this happy word. And then fucker is this kind of edgy, aggressive word. I loved how the two sounded together. So that's how the project evolved. And then, I started to think, oh, wow, this could be a PFP project, not even sure. I hadn't really looked at the PFP world seriously prior to this. I'd been so focused on the gen art space. And I thought, well, okay. So if it could just be a commentary on that space, if it's going to be a commentary on degen world, then maybe it should be a PFP project. Maybe it should be, fully baked PFP. So, I'm now sort of, I see it now as this kind of like intersection piece between, fine art, gen art, and degen culture. So it's somewhere existed in that kind of Venn diagram. So that's the basic kind of origin story of the project, I guess.
It's such a great project. It's interesting that when there's been a little bit of a trend away from PFPs, you've moved to embrace them in the opposite direction, which is I think novel. I really like the visual paradoxes that you explore through this. You just referenced that. And I'd love it if you can talk more about the interest that you gain from fusing degen culture with fine art. That's not very frequently done within our space. What excites you about that?
Well, for that reason, right, it's not been done. So, well, it's been done very little. It's silly to use the word first for in this space because there's always other people who have done things, right? But It's like, because I'm always attracted to areas, you know, where if I see a potential area that's not been explored, you know, I'm always trying to find something new and exciting, new territory. So, I mean, I was a little apprehensive about going there, to be honest, you know, before I released the project, before I announced it was me, I was like, I've spent 2 years building kind of a name in this space. And, you know, I've got some loyal collectors and stuff. And will they like this? You know, it did feel a little risky, but I went through with it anyway. But I think, you know, I do think, ironically, this project could be interesting to the wider art world more than my other work, because it's a genuine commentary on something in society. So, you know, DJing culture, whether we like it or not, is a real cultural phenomenon. It's, you know, it's made up of thousands and, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, maybe. So it's, and I think it could potentially spill out of Web3 eventually and become, you know, what, hip hop? Well, maybe not as big as hip hop or whatever, but it could influence wider society eventually, you know. So it's a kind of early commentary on that culture. And I think, you know, a lot of successful art and, you know, like, say, art outside of Web3 has that component, right? It's making some statement about society, about, you know, the time we live in. So, and of course, there's a president, right? There's things like George Kondo, there's cause, you have these kind of like cartoon-esque like characters that are used to make comment on our life today. So it's not that radical in that sense, you know. It's just following in that kind of canon of work. So yeah, it was, like I said, I don't feel I can take credit for the idea. It just happened. Like, it just unfolded in front of me, and it just felt like the right thing to do at the right time. I don't think this project could have happened for me 6 months earlier. You know, it feels like it's bringing together everything I've learned, you know, throughout my artistic career. And it's been sort of like I'm putting it together just at the right time where it makes sense to do it. So, yeah.
It is exciting to see someone like you who's had more, I guess it's fair to call it, serious traditional long form generative art embrace some of this degen culture through Chatfucker. Can you tell us a bit about the making of these works, as well as the curation of outputs that was involved in the process?
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, as I said, it's fully generative. So that means that every single element, every trait, every part of that is algorithmically produced. Apart from the only exception is actually the little Chatfucker Comic Sans word at the bottom, and with the kind of like the logo. I look at it as a signature, you know, like a Picasso signature, you know. And that's just, I wanted it to be Comic Sans just for the art, you know, for the ironic sense. And I could, you know, a lot of Microsoft, a lot of Apple phones and stuff don't have that font. So I had to actually include the path data for that. But everything else is actually just pure algorithmic, you know, code. And it means that it's a very sort of time consuming process. You know, each trait I introduce probably takes me anywhere between 1 to 3 days to build the algorithm. And it's kind of like, you know, it's like starting a new project each time. Although, you know, as I've done it a lot of times, I'm pretty proficient at it, but it also means that each time that trait is rendered, it's going to be different, right? So there's the compositions are always going to be very kind of unique. And that kind of like layering of algorithms is something that's really kind of been a revelation to me, you know, because, you know, if you look at things like Fontan or, you know, most gen art in the space, you know, it's built usually of like 1, 2, at the most like 3 kind of basic primitives. So you end up with something that's quite homogenized in terms of the visual language. But with this, you know, what I love about the process is that I get to make all these different algorithms that produce different textures and have different qualities, and just stacking all them on top of each other makes for a really sort of dynamic visual kind of like soup, you know, maybe soup's not the right word, but like a visual meal. And the kind of the fact that it's, I think, figurative helps to tie all those pieces together and make sense of all the different visual languages. So yeah, that's how it's built. I think you asked, Yeah, it's difficult to explain without sounding technical, really, but it's pure, you know, the output is SVG. So it also means that it's kind of like, it kind of suits the ordinals, you know, limitation of size. You know, it doesn't cost me a lot to inscribe these things. So I just inscribe the code and then, you know, the things still have a very sort of high resolution. Well, kind of, like with SVG, it's kind of almost like an infinite resolution because you can make these as big as you want. And they don't lose resolution because every element is kind of like a part of an equation, let's say. So it just scales perfectly. Yeah, I don't know if that was a good answer to your question or not. It may have digressed a little bit.
I think that was a great response. I really enjoy hearing you talk about the figurative element of these. I think that's sometimes the challenging component of generative art is that it's a lot of beautiful symbols and individual pieces of imagery, but we all go looking for something like the goose in Dmitry Cherniak's Ringers. We want to see something that we understand. And so the lean on figurative elements and the PFP nature of these is appreciated and might help to onboard more people to exploring generative art more broadly. I'm interested as well in the contrast that you've created with this project to some assumptions around degen culture. The Chatfucker project embraces inclusivity and diversity, which I found intriguing. Can you tell us how it does that?
Right. Yeah. So when I started looking at PFP projects, and then when, you know, I got a lot of degens join my Discord and we started to like think about traits, it just felt very sort of male centric. Gen art world is still, you know, there's still a lot more male artists than there are females, I think the broader art world is much more of an even balance, you know, like traditional art world is more of an, I wouldn't say it's perfect, but there's more women in different roles in that space and more female artists, prominent female artists. But it just felt like, oh, wow, this is still a lot of guys in there. But it had the energy of like the feel of being still a lot of guys in their basements, right? In their parents' basements. So I started thinking, well, you know, as this space matures, it's got to reach a broader audience as this culture evolves. And so, you know, it just made sense to try and make the outputs have a broader sort of appeal to different groups, different genders and so forth without being, I think majority of the outputs are fairly sort of gender agnostic, but I want some extremes in there as well. And then you know, the nice thing about generative work is you can actually sort of blend everything in between. So, you know, I create some sort of more sort of female centric traits. They're like diva nails and, you know, like eyelashes and things. I mean, these are all sort of like gross stereotypes, but I started a Chief Fuckers channel in my Discord to help. Just really, it was just to invite female sort of degens to like give me some suggestions for traits, but also just to make sure I wasn't doing anything grotesquely kind of like offensive or anything, because I felt a little nervous about getting into that territory. But you know, that channel's been really helpful in making me feel confident this is a good thing. And, you know, people seem to really, the sisters in the Discord seem to really like it. And the other thing I did learn actually was that there are a lot more female degens and art collectors out there, but they often have like PFP, like male orientated PFPs, or they use male orientated names. And I think often just to make it easier for them to kind of like, you know, not, I don't know. So I think that should change, you know, we should. And, you know, I will have a small number of like, not in this batch, but in future batches, I want to make some LGBTQ fuckers, you know, some sort of gay pride fuckers and things like that. Because, you know, I think as PFPs evolve, you know, I think they will, like, the whole identity part of PFPs has become stronger and stronger. And I think as we spend more time in virtual spaces, we will be looking to find different ways to represent our identity, which is just a fundamental part of what it is to be a human being, right? We'll want our PFPs to kind of like, I think eventually, you know, to represent our values, you know. So I think, you know, the future PFPs could become quite nuanced and complex over time, you know. And so this is what I'm trying to trying to see how kind of nuanced and complex I can make it with this approach. And that's been like an interesting kind of like it's an interesting example of how this project requires certain types of thinking and, you know, discussion. Then, you know, obviously when I was building Fontana, I didn't ever think about these issues. You know, it was just like one thing. But with Chatfucker, it seems like it involves many different kind of areas, you know, lots of thinking and talking and like talking to the community to kind of like find good solutions.
It's great that you're using this project to create space for everyone to express themselves, and a good reminder as well that there are lots of variety of degens hiding behind some more narrow PFPs out there today. So we'll probably see that increase into the future. One last question related to Chatfucker. You're pricing these works quite affordably and holding back some of the supply to ensure that you can maintain an affordable price into the future. What led you to take that approach?
Well, it just seemed like there's been so... Well, you know, there was a danger that me doing this on ordinals that it would look like a cash grab. So I'd certainly... It's not, you know, it's certainly not a cash grab. So I'm pretty conscious about that. I think I had good luck. My first year, I'd done really well financially. And the projects that minted the heart, you know, like Vellum, you know, I felt like I minted too high. and I feel I have a responsibility to not sell my stuff cheap, but to be really focused on innovation and continue to kind of give to the, well, to do my best work and innovate, because I think that's how I'll add value back to those collections going forward, you know, to continue to be an artist who continuously innovates. And so, but basically that haven't had that good fortune in the first year, kind of, it gives me the freedom to do projects which are maybe a bit more risky, and I don't have to focus on making a high return. You know, I think, you know, it's still $100 if I sell, you know, if I sell, eventually sell out the, you know, full collection, that's still a lot of money, you know, so it's not like cheap. It's still, I think the money you make from a project should be, you know, proportional to the strength of your career. And, you know, my career is only really 2 years old, although I've been making art for a long time. I think, you know, in art, it's still only 2 years old. I just think, you know, art should be realistic about their pricing and it just makes for a more sustainable future going forward. You know, it's not good to sell work for millions on your first drop. It's not something you can repeat and build upon. You know, it's not going to be sustainable. It's going to leave a lot of collectors feeling bad when the market can't support those prices. So it just makes sense on many levels just to do, you know, if you're going to do a high supply project to price it very affordably. It's also, you know, I like the idea of being given lots of different people access to the project. I'm holding some supply, but I realized like I was originally going to hold 10%, and I realized that's way too much. And so I'm splitting that amongst, I'm setting some aside for charity fund, and also some aside for a community fund to help fund like events and parties and stuff. So I just feel like, you know, there's been so many examples of PFP projects that are minted at, you know, at a high price, and then they've left a really bad taste in, you know, the community's, you know, mouths. We all know the projects, and I just feel like it's dangerous. You know, if you delivered a PFP project at a very high price, you know, high primary price, and you don't, you know, you made millions and you, I don't know, just didn't follow up and deliver or whatever, it's going to be really harmful to your career. So, you know, I think it's just like sound realistic kind of pricing. You know, I even thought about giving them away, but then I thought, well, it needs some kind of friction. So I think like $100 is enough friction. That was my thinking, really.
I appreciate this thoughtful approach to building a sustainable project and community. And it certainly sounds like we've heard evidence from the trad art world that too much excitement right at the beginning of the launch of something often fizzles later on. So kudos to you for putting the thought into the longevity of this project and your own work as well. Turning to some of your other works, you mentioned Vellum, which you released with Bright Moments at the beginning of 2023. This is the first of a four-movement series. Can you tell us what this project involves and how it will continue to grow through the four different stages?
So Vellum was, like, when I started the project, I was thinking like of a symphony, you know, a four-movement symphony dropped over 4 years. So the basic idea, I built the Vellum algorithm and I would revisit it a year later and kind of like rework it, rebuild it, basically using the same sort of fundamental primitive and do another drop of 100. So the entire supply of it will still only be for like 400 over 4 years. And that was when I first built that algorithm, that was always my intention. Bright Moments at the time didn't want me to kind of like talk about it much because they felt like it introduced noise to the drop. So I didn't talk about it a lot back then, but I was always planning to do that. And then also it enables me to kind of create an interesting kind of like reward structure. So for instance, like when I drop Vellum 2, if you hold Vellum 1, you'll get a 33% discount. And then when I drop Vellum 3, if you hold 1 and 2, you'll get 66% discount. And then when I drop Vellum 4, you'll get, you know, if you hold all a full set, you'll get a 99% discount, which is just basically like giving it away and still having to kind of go through the, you know, simple way of still having to make a purchase. So I liked that kind of reward mechanism. And, you know, it was when I built the algorithm for Bright Moments, you know, Bright Moments was kind of constrained to doing 100. And I just felt like, well, there's a lot more I can do with this algorithm. It seemed like a shame just to mint 100. So that was also sort of like what kind of made me kind of committed to doing this kind of long thing. But I do like generally things that evolve and open up over a long period of time. I mean, again, like coming back to Chatbug, is there something that's going to, you know, it's going to be dropped in multiple batches over the course of who knows how long. It might take me a year, might take me 3 years. I don't know. But I like that kind of like long, slow release because it's more in tune with the way I work. You know, I like big, ambitious projects and big, ambitious projects take a long time. You know, I think it's a good antidote for this space. You know, as a consequence, I think I'll end up attracting more sort of like loyal collectors who are more in tune with, you know, who have that sort of broader vision, that long-term vision. And I would say like a realistic vision who value things that take time. So, you know, on one level, it may not be, people may think it doesn't look optimal in terms of like, you know, maybe maxing your profits. But, you know, at this point, I really don't care about that. It's more about trying to find a way of working and distributing, releasing work that's in tune with the natural sort of flow of my work. Whether it's optimal or not, it's just, you know, it's the only way to be sustainable. You know, as an artist, you've got to find ways to make your practice sustainable, and that means you've got to enjoy it and it's got to be natural to the way and sort of you work. So yeah, that was the thinking behind that.
It's fun to be part of a project that continues to evolve. I think it allows your community to feel like they're joining the artist on their journey. Your work, Wonderland Entropy, was sold last year at the Sotheby's auction, Contemporary Discoveries. What was it like to see this piece at auction alongside works by David Hockney, Andy Warhol, and George Kondo?
Yeah, it was mind-blowing, actually. Funny enough, we went to New York City, I think it was it NFT NYC last year, and we almost didn't go to the Sotheby's kind of like showrooms or gallery, I guess you'd call it. Because I just figured the piece would be hanging in a back room somewhere, like, then, you know, like just on its own, or I don't know. But when we turned up there and it was in this big white gallery space, you know, there was a David Hockney literally 6 feet around the corner, it blew my mind, you know, because that was always my dream, you know, as a young man and so forth. I used to spend a lot of time in big contemporary art galleries and, you know, the National Gallery in London and something clicked in me when I saw it there and watched people look at it. I thought, wow, wouldn't, you know, although of course I'm dedicated to, you know, Web3 art and this space. I also thought, wouldn't it be nice to make kind of collections, NFT collections that also have a physical kind of component to that work, a physical kind of like expression of like a long form project that is designed specifically for this type of environment, this big, you know, white cube gallery environment. So that's still something I'm, you know, excited about. I still, you know, I'm really excited, well, hoping to see chat fuckers in a big white gallery one day. I think they'll work, you know, like on a 10-foot canvas or whatever. I think, you know, despite all the crazy elements and everything, and I think I'm still sort of designing them in a way to work in that type of environment. So yeah, it's something that, like, I think it was like, wasn't really validation, but it gave me confidence to like maybe to try and target the world, you know, the wider sort of like traditional art world, and maybe think, okay, maybe it's possible for me to kind of like make some inroads. Because bear in mind, you know, I tried in my 20s to show my work, you know, to get gallery representation and stuff, and I gave up. So it's just kind of like, oh, maybe this could happen, you know, maybe I can get my work in museums one day, you know.
It puts a smile on my face imagining Chad Fucker at a Sotheby's auction or in a prominent museum down the road, and I won't be surprised at all if we see that. Your project Quasi Dragon Studies incorporates a unique element where collectors can actively participate in the creation process by combining tiles into composites. What appeals to you about co-creation, and how does it influence your approach to your artwork?
Okay, yeah, co-creation. I think, you know, that project Quasi Dragon Studies, well, that last year was the first time I really started to think about this. The first time I thought about it was when Fontana dropped, and then just been like in the Block Talk Discord for the week, and, you know, the few months in which it went kind of like the floor went like 13x, and there was this kind of big sort of celebration of the project in Block Talk for a few weeks. I realized that actually the community was like an integral part of like the full realization of the project, you know, like that those weeks after the project dropped were somehow the community was part of the work. So that got me thinking. And then Quasi Dragon Studies was like a more, you know, ambitious exploration of this. But I do think, you know, the blurring, I think that in 20 years time, when we look back at this moment, this Web3 moment, yeah, things like gen art, AI art will be interesting, but they're only mediums, right? So, and after a while, new mediums aren't new anymore, and they're not interesting in themselves in the same way that oil paint is not interesting in itself. It's what you do with it, you know? So the thing that will be really kind of like, well, I think we'll look back on and think, oh, that was a big thing. That was a new thing, right? Is this kind of blurring, is the community involvement in the creation of work, or the blurring between artist and community co-creation. I think this will be like one of the things that's quite new to Web3. I wouldn't say entirely new, but there's not a lot of parallels prior to Web3 in art. So it just, for me, it's like, that's the interesting area to explore, because it's something new, right? We're all, as us, we're trying to do something that's really new. So it's just like a no brainer. And also, like, it's, haven't worked for so long, you know, for 25 years seriously as an artist with no audience. It's like when I started to get an audience, I just took a complete swing. You know, it felt like, I just don't take it for granted. I just think it's an amazing thing. And the community is an amazing resource. You know, I get so many good ideas from my Discord community and so forth. So it's a tool for me. It's a creative tool, but it's also fun. You know, I like people. I like meeting people. So why not? You know, I think the journey is going to be far more interesting if you do it with a community who are following you, you know, your progress. Yeah, it's just like, why? I mean, I think it also ties, you know, it's something I can do because it's part of my, I'm quite extrovert. I like people. I like meeting people. I've never found it draining to meet people. I know a lot of people do, especially a lot of artists are quite introverted, you know, and maybe throw them in a social, you know, like a space full of people they don't know. They might find that quite like draining, but for whatever reason, I've always found it quite energizing. So it's kind of natural for me to go down this route of kind of including the community whenever I can, I think.
That approach to co-creation does seem like one of the unique elements of the NFT Web3 space, and happy to see you've explored it and are continuing to embrace it in your Discord, as you referenced with the Chat Fucker project. Really looking forward to seeing how that evolves over time. One final question related to collecting. Bob Lucas is a founder of Station 3, a Web3 community hub, and he has acquired more than 30 works from your Fontana series. What do you see as the role of larger collectors or patrons like Bob within the digital art sphere?
Interesting question. I've not really thought about this before. Bob was like, when Bob bought, when Fontana was starting to get some traction and Bob swept the floor numerous times. I think he's got 37 Fontanas now. That definitely helped to build people's confidence in the project. You know, I think a lot of collectors, whether they be traditional art collectors or Web3 collectors, they're not necessarily very confident in, what they're buying. I mean, this is we see this in, the whole role of the specialist at Sotheby's, that job is there, that person is there to help to reassure that, the collectors that they're buying something that's important, right? So those big moves by big collectors, they obviously send a signal to the rest of the community, okay, this project is worth in investing in, and the whole investment side of things, the whole wealth flex, this is a real part of art, whether we like it or not. This is something that's real, and I always try to be as realistic as possible. So they do definitely have a role. I think, just looking again at art history, you look at the kind of collectors that are built around like Andy Warhol and how they supported his prices. For many, still do to this day. Would Warhol be as important an artist today if he didn't have those sort of those collectors? I don't think he would have been. So that they are important in terms of cementing the artists in history, I guess, for better or worse. But yeah, they do have a role. Do they make the best choices? I don't know. I mean, they're just humans. I don't know. But yeah, I'm certainly grateful to Bob. I'm going to donate an algorithm to his Station 3 project this summer because I want to give something back to what I feel like he's given me.
Well, very thoughtful response. It's I think it's a great insight that whatever one feels about patrons or larger collectors, their presence within this space and something that should be acknowledged and accounted for within projects. And it sounds like you have a good rapport there. So happy to hear that. Harvey, you've been very generous with your time today. Is there anything else that you would like to share with us before we wrap up?
Just thanking people for listening. I always say I don't take it for granted. I hope I never will take it for granted. It's part of why I say I think it's just to remind myself not to take it for granted, because I know what it's like to have to make work and have nobody to see it. I don't think I'll ever forget that. So yeah, just thank people for listening and thank you for having me up here today. It's been a great, you've asked some really good questions. You've done some amazing homework. I love, I particularly like to talk about my work when the questions make me stop and think and I don't have an answer. So you've asked a few of them today. So that's been great. And would love to do this again one day. It's certainly, if, I don't know if you'll be at Martha, but it'd be great to meet up again, this year at some point.
That would be wonderful. And given the fact that you are consistently challenging yourself to discover new frontiers and to create work that expands our idea of what art can be, I have no doubt that we'll have a lot more to talk about into the future. Thank you once again for joining us to share your story.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review. And don't forget to join us at our next Collector's Call.